From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're doing something a little different. Our reporters have been getting to the bottom of questions that you asked.
Hi, my name is Jeanette, and I'm a teacher from Atlanta, Georgia.
This is Jack from Dallas, Texas.
Wendy Robinson. I live in Northampton, Massachusetts.
We put the word out last fall that we wanted to know what you wanted to know about immigration.
Who decides how many immigrants will be allowed in the country each year?
What happens to people when they're deported? Do they just get put on an airplane and then kind of dumped at the airport?
I'm wondering about how Trump's stance on immigration will affect our ability to secure a green card for my wife.
Today, we're going to answer some of the more than 300 questions we got back, starting with a question from a listener who does a lot of listening.
Oh, my God. All day long. I actually have to take a break sometimes because I feel like I'm going to lose my mind.
His name is Alex Potyak, and he keeps the radio on while he's working.
See, I'm a truck driver, and I'm actually driving right now. I've got about 236 miles still left to do today.
It was one of these long drives that first took him to the U.S.-Mexico border.
And I parked the truck, and I walked out into the desert, into the mesquite bushes. And everywhere you looked, there was backpacks and canned food. And it was obvious that people were traveling through the desert.
The question he had was, why? Why would all these people risk everything to sneak into the United States?
I thought all number of things. I thought, okay, these are probably families or could be drug dealers, of course. I mean, everyone has a different reason. And I'd like to know more as about that. What motivated you to come here?
The number of people crossing the border illegally is higher than last year, but way down over the long term. It's half of what it was back in the 90s. But it's still hundreds of thousands of people. And like Alex said, each one has a different reason. So instead of answering Alex's question of why people come with one person's story, we thought we'd bring you a roomful. By listening in to a Monday morning in a federal courthouse in Del Rio, Texas.
Court in the court, all rise.
This is where the Trump administration, a couple months ago, said it would try to send every person caught crossing the border.
That's Reveal reporter Stan Alcorn.
A federal courtroom where they're criminally prosecuted and given prison time for illegal entry.
Thank you. Please sit down.
So the judge here is not an immigration judge. He's a federal magistrate. His name's Collis White.
Sorry, we're getting started a little late this morning.
He's got white hair, black robe, and he's looking down at a courtroom packed with 46 men and women, each wearing an orange jumpsuit, what looks like a paper surgical mask, a headset to hear the English-Spanish translation, and shackles. They have shackles on their ankles, waists, and wrists. They're all connected with these metal chains.
The first thing we'll do is administer an oath. I know it's hard with the shackles, but I want you to raise your right hand as well as you can.
One of the stranger things about this legal process is you don't really hear from the people at the center of it. In the hour and a half I spent watching this back in 2015, the only thing the 46 defendants said was yes, no, guilty, just one-word answers to questions from the judge.
Each of you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God, yes or no, beginning with you, Mr. Arizimende Guadarrama.
Si.
Sir?
Si.
You can sit down after you've answered the question.
Si.
But the reason I thought of this courtroom when I heard the listener's question is that you do hear why each person came. You hear it from their lawyer.
Judge, this gentleman has been married for 17 years. This is the first time he's been outside of the presence of his family.
Jack Stern is the defense attorney for 14 men and 4 women in that courtroom. And the only defense he really has is to tell each of their stories and hope the judge will shorten their prison sentences.
He was a witness to a murder in his neighborhood. He waited for the assassin to leave, then went outside. Apparently another neighbor heard gunshots and then came out. When the other neighbor was interviewed, he advised authorities that the defendant had seen the entire incident. Given the lack of a thin blue line between law enforcement and gangs in Honduras, he decided for his own personal safety, he'd head north. That's why he's here.
For the last couple years, most of the people crossing the border illegally haven't been from Mexico. They've been coming from more than 1,000 miles away, from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras.
I know things are bad in Honduras.
And half the stories I heard from these Central American migrants were about escaping violence and persecution.
All right.
But most of the migrants from just across the border, from Mexico,
Alberto Valencia Zetina,
their stories were different.
Judge, the defendant is a construction worker by vocation. Judge, the defendant is a subsistence field worker. He works as a packager or a stocker. Judge, he paints, works in the fields, and has done so since he was 12 years of age.
These are men and women doing work that doesn't require a lot of education and doesn't pay very well.
He earns a little less than $90 a week, approximately $40 a week, $10 a day. That's not sufficient to support his household as well as his kids' studies.
You can make a lot more money doing the same kind of work in the United States. And the crux of these stories is what they hope to do with that money.
He put his six kids through school. He's got six more he needs to support, and that's why he came back. And I simply ask that you have some mercy on him.
All these stories I heard in court, they fit with some of the best data we have on this. Surveys by the Mexican government show around 90% of Mexican migrants are coming to the U.S. to work.
That's why he's here.
There have been a lot of changes in immigration policy since I was in that courtroom in 2015. One of the most recent is a so-called zero-tolerance policy, where the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has called for criminally prosecuting everyone caught crossing the border, even parents who are then separated from their children. So more people are being sent to courtrooms like the one I visited. But when it comes to what happens in court, I got a recent recording, same judge, same lawyer.
Is there anything you'd like to say?
And listening back, it sounds the same.
I understand why you come here, but listen, you've got to stop doing this. You've already been in this courtroom, or at least in this courthouse, convicted of exactly the same charge. Was I the judge who sentenced you?
Yes.
But I tell you, I told you that every time you come back, you go to jail for a longer period of time. Last time I gave you 13 days in jail, today will be 120. Next time it can be 2 years. You can sit down.
What you hear, and what defense attorney Jack Stern says, is it's the rare exception where the reasons people come actually convince the judge to give them less time in prison.
Mendez Gerardo Camacho, 120 days of incarceration.
How can I say it? I mean, you know, just a grinder. That's all it is. I mean, it's just continual, okay? You hear the same stories. And most of them are, grab your heart. And for the most part, there's not squat you can do for them.
That story is from Reveal's Stan Alcorn. Prison sentences for crossing the border can range from a few days to years. But what happens at the end is almost always the same: deportation. After that, some deported men and women end up just across the border in the town of Acuña. At the Casa del Migrante, a shelter for the recently deported, started at a local Catholic church.
Hello.
¿Cómo está? Me llamo Ana Yancy Díaz Cortés.
Reveals Ana Yancy Díaz Cortés gave them a call on a recent Wednesday just after a group of men arrived.
Bien, bien. Me llamo Álvaro.
Álvaro Corona Acosta is 22 years old and lives in Ciudad Obregón, an agricultural city 300 miles south of Tucson.
I have two daughters, and I worked very hard for them, but it wasn't enough here in Mexico.
He says he had to work three jobs to pay the bills. He was struggling to buy a refrigerator in installments, and he just didn't make enough to get through the week. And so, over and over, he would cross the border to the U.S. to make more money, only to be caught and deported. This last time, after spending 6 months in prison.
I was scared, you know, because I wouldn't be able to see my daughter for a long time. They grab you and they throw you into jail. They don't care if you have family or not. They just want to hammer you.
sea martillazo.
Has it always been this way? Has the U.S. always been so harsh on people crossing the border without the right papers? Reporter Laura Benshoff with public radio station WHYY in Philadelphia has a question along those lines from a listener, Judy Idelson. Hey, Laura.
Hey, Al.
So what did Judy want to know?
Well, Judy is wondering about the history of white people immigrating to the U.S.
I think a lot of people with European backgrounds think they somehow are more American or they're more legitimate in their American citizenship. And I want to know, how did their families get here?
I agree with Judy. I mean, I hear this sentiment a lot in our immigration debate. Really, it's a function of white supremacy, because if you break it down, immigration policy is about deciding who is more legitimate, which, like so many things in America, tends to be based on race.
Right. And of course, this has been going on for a long time. And Judy wants to talk about a time specifically when there were tons of people coming from Europe. What were the laws then, and were people actually following them? And she has an immigration secret in her own family's history that she's going to tell us. So she came along with me on this whole reporting journey.
All right, I'll let you take it from here.
To get started, I go to Judy's house.
Hi.
Hey, Judy.
Found it.
I did. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
She's a psychologist in her early 60s who lives in Bala Cynwyd, a well-off suburb west of Philadelphia. After her kids went away to college, she started working with immigrants applying for legal status in the U.S., mostly asylum. She documents their trauma to help their cases.
Let me show you some things upstairs, can I?
Sure.
We head to her home office, where she shows me a wall-sized map of the world.
This is a map my daughter created for me.
Okay.
With a pin for each person whose case I worked on to get asylum.
There are more than 300 pushpins tacked to the map, representing people from dozens of countries. Judy knows just how high the bar is to immigrate today because she's helped almost all of these people clear it. To answer her question about how people used to get here, we call up a historian who can tell us about when that bar was much lower. Mei Nye is a history professor at Columbia University who focuses specifically on immigration.
You know, until the 1920s, we had virtually an open door from Europe, that is, into the United States.
Mei says not all immigrants from Europe were viewed kindly before then, but if you could get yourself here, government officials didn't ask too many questions.
They wanted to make sure you had a little cash in your pocket so you wouldn't become a public charge. They wanted to make sure you didn't have what was called a dangerous or loathsome disease. They wanted to make sure you weren't a prostitute.
They wanted to make sure you could work, that you'd be self-sufficient. So there was this open door. And more than 20 million Europeans streamed through it around the turn of the 20th century. They came from Italy, from Germany, from Poland, from all over Europe. Meanwhile, Mei Nye told me and Judy, the U.S. had started banning entire groups of people based on their race.
Chinese were the first group to ever be excluded by name.
That was the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882.
Was that just Chinese? Mei, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, in 1882, it was Chinese, but later Japanese were excluded and people from South Asia were excluded.
So the government barred most people from Asia, and suspicion of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe was building. Richard White is a historian at Stanford University.
Most people would break it down into good immigrants and bad immigrants. And good immigrants tended to be Northern European, Protestant, and white. Bad immigrants were everybody else.
Labor unions worried immigrant workers would drive down wages, and there was a political movement to preserve the so-called racial purity of white America. Richard says that to justify keeping the bad European immigrants out, these groups relied on a list of nasty stereotypes.
Catholics, they can't really be Republican citizens because they'll do whatever the Pope and the priest tells them to do. Jews, the argument was Jews have no loyalty to anybody but other Jews. They will never have loyalty to the United States.
That list was long.
The Italians are violent. The Italians are naturally thieves. Other groups are lazy. They're ignorant. They simply cannot be educated.
In 1924, these anti-immigrant groups got their way. Congress passed the Johnson-Reed Act, which used quotas to encourage immigration from places like England, while making it much harder for Italians and Polish people and other Southern and Eastern Europeans to come. These quotas were a game changer. Putting a number on how many people could come from each country, that meant that immigrants had to get in a line, that they could be turned away en masse. The basic anxiety driving this law, the fear that the U.S. has too many immigrants, it's made a comeback.
We're continuing on a path each year to have higher numbers than the year before, reaching in 7 years, we'll have the highest percentage of Americans, non-native born, since the founding of the Republic.
That's Jeff Sessions talking on Breitbart News Radio in 2015, before he became Attorney General. The numbers he's referring to come from research published by the Pew Research Center, which said about 14% of people in the U.S. were born in another country. Sessions went on to praise the Johnson-Reed Act.
When the numbers reached about this high in 1924, the President and Congress changed the policy, and it slowed down immigration significantly. And we then assimilated and created really the solid middle class. And it was good for America.
Those quotas he's talking about did slow down legal immigration to the U.S. But when that door closed, some people just went around it. Historian Richard White says at the time, there was basically no border control.
The Canadian border is wide open. There's just no way to patrol that border. And it's also largely true of the Mexican border.
In the 1920s, the U.S. Immigration Service estimated about 1.5 million immigrants could have snuck into the country. Articles in the New York Times described people from Czechoslovakia and Poland paying smugglers with boats in Cuba or to get them across the U.S. border with Canada. Richard says that's what his own Irish grandfather did in 1924. After a trip back to Ireland a few years later, he applied to live in the U.S. legally, sort of.
I've seen his petition for citizenship, and virtually everything on it except for his name is either a lie or wrong. I mean, he even has his own birthday wrong. He has his wife's birthday wrong. He can't list the correct number of his children.
Lying on official paperwork? That's also breaking immigration law. But a lot of European immigrants got away with it. By the end of that decade, the government had created an amnesty program for people who couldn't prove how they crossed the border. When Judy hears this, she says she's struck by the lack of consequences for people who today would most likely face jail time or deportation.
Even though there were quotas, if people snuck in and they got here one way or another, they would make their life, they'd start a family. They weren't living for the rest of their lives in fear.
This is where we get to Judy's family's story. It starts with World War II, when a huge and deadly consequence of these quotas emerges. These restrictions kept Jews who escaped death during the Holocaust from coming to the U.S. Judy's dad was one of them.
My father's name was Shaika Ivansky, and he was born in a town called Janova in Lithuania.
He was a teenager when the German army invaded.
He lost his parents, his brother, and his sister during the war.
Shaika escaped to a Jewish ghetto and took a new name, essentially pretending to be someone else. Judy says for the next 4 years, he lied whenever he had to stay alive.
He was in Dachau, in a work camp, and they needed men to paint. And so he said he was a painter. He was not a painter, but he said he was a painter.
In another work camp, he said he was a carpenter. When the war ended, he made his way to a refugee camp in Germany. Shaika's home was gone, and like many Holocaust survivors, he didn't want to return to a country that had worked with the Nazis. To get out of limbo and be with the woman he would marry, Judy's dad told a different kind of lie to the U.S. government.
It was considered sort of a funny, whimsical story that my father had to pretend that he was going to rabbinical school, that he was going to study to become a rabbi in order to get a visa to come into the country.
He got a letter of admission from a school in Baltimore that he used to get a student visa. Shaika had no intention of becoming a rabbi. He later became a bookkeeper. Judy told me that he didn't talk about this lie outside the family. And she says it didn't really hit her until after he died, that what he did was really serious.
Did he become a criminal by U.S. immigration laws? He did. That was immigration fraud.
She says he carried the fear he would be deported for the rest of his life. And she realized under today's laws, it's much less likely he would have gotten away with it.
He would never have gotten into this country. And my parents would not have been married, and I wouldn't exist. And that was chilling.
So, Laura, based on what you and Judy found, it sounds like a lot of white Americans could have stories like this in their past.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Judy and I both learned is just that it wasn't that hard for a long time if you were from Europe to gain entry to this country. And then when those walls did sort of start coming up, people were very creative in the ways they came around them. We just don't know how many people did that.
So even if they'd entered illegally, they were just able to become citizens?
Yes. There were some amnesty programs that let people who didn't have any documents to show how they came into the U.S. get status. And the big takeaway here is pre-1920s, we didn't see the massive amounts of energy and resources put into policing immigrants that we have today.
Thanks to listener Judy Idelson and reporter Laura Benchoff from WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. Up next, we're flashing forward.
It's becoming very difficult to get permanent status in the United States.
Breaking down today's immigration laws. That's coming up on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.